From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a woman reporter behind the lines of the war in Chechnya. We talk with French journalist Anne Neva. After being denied permission from Russian authorities to enter Chechnya, Neva disguised herself as a peasant and crossed the border. For 6 months, she traveled with the Chechen rebels and stayed with families. She's written a new memoir. Also, Avant-Garde Made Easy. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead begins a six-part series on modern jazz mavericks. Part one, composer and bandleader Sun Ra. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The budget issued today by President Bush proposes some cuts in health programs, but not nearly as deep as health advocates had feared. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
Overall, the Department of Health and Human Services came out a winner in the budget math game, slated for just over a 5% increase in programs that are not automatically funded. The biggest increases have already been announced, an additional $2.75 billion for the National Institutes of Health, and more than $100 million more for community health centers that serve the poor and uninsured. But health advocacy groups worry that with a 60% cut proposed for programs that train health professionals, there won't be the doctors and nurses to staff those new health centers. Congress is also expected to reverse a proposed 15% cut in a new program that provides funds to help train doctors in children's hospitals, as well as cuts to a variety of rural health programs. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush warned again today that relations between the United States and China could be harmed if the Chinese government doesn't release an American surveillance plane and its 24-member crew. The two sides have been negotiating over the issue for the past 9 days. China still insists that the United States must take responsibility for the collision that downed a Chinese jet and left its pilot missing. Chinese officials are also demanding an apology. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said the administration doesn't owe China an apology, although President Bush has said he regrets the loss of the Chinese pilot, and Secretary of State Colin Powell has said the U.S. is sorry for the pilot's death. One of the best quarterbacks in professional football has retired. Troy Aikman, who led the Dallas Cowboys to 3 Super Bowl titles, announced his retirement today, a month after he was released by the Cowboys. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
When 34-year-old Troy Aikman was cut by the Cowboys, he still hoped to play for someone else, but back problems and the estimated 10 concussions during his career made Aikman more of a liability to other teams. So he decided to retire, calling it the right thing to do because of his health. A tearful Aikman said, quote, "You think your time will never come, and my time has come." Aikman is one of those lucky athletes who won't have to make the jarring transition from public adulation to obscurity. Handsome and articulate, he's expected to sign on as a network football TV broadcaster. Aikman played his entire 12-year career in Dallas. Once known as America's team, the Cowboys were struggling when Aikman was drafted in 1989. He helped Dallas recapture its glory with Super Bowl victories in 1993, 94, and 96. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 54 points to close at 9,845 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq gained 25 points, or 1.5%. It closed at 1,745. This is NPR News. American Airlines has bought most of the assets of Trans World Airlines. American was able to complete the purchase after a federal judge rejected a last-minute effort to stop the sale filed by a group of TWA workers in Israel. The government has issued a safety warning about a type of van commonly used by church and school groups and airport shuttle services, and an insurance group's latest rating of sport utility vehicles and pickup trucks found that most did very poorly in low-speed crash tests. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration issued the warning, citing research showing that 15-passenger vans are 3 times as likely to roll over when fully loaded. Studies have found that the center of gravity shifts upward and back when 10 or more passengers are aboard. The agency says the vans, such as those made by Ford, Chevrolet, GMC, and Dodge, should only be operated by experienced drivers. The warning comes after several fatal van accidents involving college sports teams. The latest crash tests by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety have found that while SUVs and pickups may look rugged, most sustained extensive damage even when hitting a barrier at only 5 miles an hour. Of the small SUVs tested, the Toyota RAV4 earned the worst marks. Only Ford's Escape earned an acceptable rating for crashworthiness. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
People in the eastern Dakotas and Minnesota are fighting floodwaters today. Rivers in the area have been swollen by heavy rains and melting snow. The National Weather Service predicts that parts of the Red River will rise to about 4 feet above the current top of the dike system. The Red River forms the border between North Dakota and Minnesota. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services and its employees, helping the hungry through the Sodexo Servathon, on the web at sodexomarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Anne Neva, is a French journalist who has covered the war in Chechnya by disguising herself as a Chechen woman. She risked being kidnapped by Chechens and arrested by Russians, or killed in crossfire or bombings. Her only connection to the outside world was the satellite phone she used to file her stories. She says she lived through hell, but the will to do her job and never stop writing kept her going. She's written a new memoir called Chien de Guerre. Neva speaks Russian fluently and has been based for several years in Moscow. She first went to Chechnya in 1996, at the end of the first war, in which the Chechens fought for independence from Russia. She returned in 1997 briefly during the presidential elections. In 1999, at the beginning of the second Russian-Chechen war, she applied in Russia for press credentials to return to Chechnya. As she expected, she was denied. The Russians don't want journalists covering the war on their own. I asked her about her decision to try and cross the border by dressing as a Chechen woman.
Not having this special accreditation, I had to be very discreet. And I just noticed that being a woman was of a great help, because people don't pay attention to women down there in this Muslim country. You are a woman, you are nobody, which is awful. But in that case, it played in my favor. I just had a look around me and saw that every woman was dressed in a long skirt and was wearing a scarf. Which I did, understanding that that would help me to be discreet. And that's exactly what happened. I would just be dressed like any other Chechen woman, and I would never hide the fact that I'm a journalist, that I'm a correspondent, but I would also not advertise it. For example, when I was crossing military checkpoints, thousands of military checkpoints. Chechnya is almost only made of military checkpoints on destroyed roads. I would just stay silent in the car and basically wait and see. Of course, there was a risk every time. Every time there was a risk that the Russian soldier would ask me for my ID. I've been very lucky. No one asked, ever.
Is that how invisible you were as a woman, that they didn't even ask you for ID?
They didn't ask for ID at all. They would always ask to the driver of the car, like every man sitting in the car. Or even better, I would cross checkpoints by foot. If I was walking with a bag, like a plastic bag with me, I would be completely invisible, completely. If I did what I did, that's just because, first of all, I was discreet, which is usually not really common among journalists, I must say. And so the fact that I'm a woman helped me. The fact that I'm a written press journalist was also of a great help, because that means I had no sort of external signs of being a journalist, like no microphone, no camera. And also, of course, the fact that I speak Russian, although Chechens do have their own language, Chechen language, but they all speak Russian.
You did, however, have a satellite phone. How did you hide that? Because you used your satellite phone to file for your newspapers.
Yes, you're right. You are right. The satellite phone is the only piece of techniques I had with me. And I would... It was difficult, actually, to keep this satellite phone with me. I didn't know where to put it. Not obviously not in this plastic bag, because that would be sort of too obvious that there was something strange in it. So I strapped it to my belly. That was the only solution. And it was very uncomfortable. But this satellite phone was my only link to the external world. And I remember the very first time I happened to be under heavy bombardment. And I was just talking to my editor a few minutes before the first plane appeared in the sky. And I had to stop the conversation and sort of abandon the satellite phone and run away somewhere. And I didn't want to abandon the satellite phone. I ran back in order to take it back, because I was paralyzed. The very idea to lose this phone was so awful for me.
Russian officials have said that they're fighting this war in Chechnya to prevent Islamic terrorism from spreading. But what are the different types of Islam you saw in Chechnya?
During the 6 months I was there, without a break, I didn't see a single sign of Islamic fanatism. Chechens are very... when they practice their religion, they are Sunni Muslims. So I was there during Ramadan, for example, and people would not eat, of course, all day long, and pray, do a lot of praying. But not a single time I felt sort of aggressiveness in their behaving, in the way they practice their religion. That struck me. That really struck me. And the fact that the Kremlin wants the outside world to believe that this is a religious war is very disturbing to me, because they are first claiming that this is an anti-terrorist operation, and but the reality is that there is no anti-terrorist operation. There is a full-scale, nasty war, and who is suffering? Not the rebels, not the so-called terrorists. The civilians are suffering, unfortunately. What's happening in Chechnya today is beyond the comprehension of normal culture. It's just a shame that that Chechnya is part of Russia, and that Russia doesn't do anything to stop this war. It's just the opposite, by the way.
What do you think the war is really about?
This war is a colonial war. That's a typical colonial war that has been raging for ages. It's not new. This war started in October 1999, but there was the first war between 1994-1996. And before that, I mean, basically, Chechens and Russians have been fighting since the 18th century. Russia wanting to expand its territory to the south, and the Chechen people, the highlanders from Chechnya, fighting back to preserve their nationality, their culture. So right now, Russia is a federation. It is made of 89 regions, Chechnya being one of the 89, and they are fighting for their independence, and the Kremlin doesn't want to set them free. They want to keep them within the Russian Federation for many reasons. The main reason being that, first of all, Chechnya is an oil-rich territory, and secondly, to allow independence to Chechnya would mean... would create a precedent, and that means that other regions of the Russian Federation could just try the same, which is exactly what the new president, Vladimir Putin, doesn't want. He wants to show to the entire world that Russia is still a strong country. that Russia, and that's why he was elected, because the Russians want to feel this strength of their own country. You know, after a decade ago, the Soviet Union was collapsing. And I think what's happening in Chechnya is, of course, one of the consequences of this collapse, because it's sort of Russia is in seeking for its identity, and in a way, it needs enemies, and fighting against the Chechens helps them to know who they are.
My guest is French journalist Anne Neva. She's written a memoir about covering the war in Chechnya called Chien de Guerre. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is French journalist Anne Neva. Her new memoir about covering the war in Chechnya is called Chien de Guerre. You were just in Grozny about 4 weeks ago in your continued efforts to cover the war there. What phase of the war would you say it's in now?
It is a very strange phase because basically not much seems to be happening. But in fact, that's not true. What is happening is total chaos. There is no rule in Chechnya at all. And when the Russians pretend that they have the situation under control, that is not true. Absolutely not true. Everyone lives in fear of being arrested at any time. Being a man is, of course, more dangerous than being a woman, because basically every man is a potential rebel, is a potential terrorist for the Kremlin, for Moscow. So if you are a man aged between like 13, 15 and 60 and you want to, for example, go outside of your house and walk down the street in Grozny, if you can call it a street, and come back with some water that you take from the water pump, and if there is a checkpoint in between your house and the pump, you can just get stopped by them at the checkpoint and disappear. Well, we've been talking about filtration camps, and I didn't see any filtration camps because they are not that easy to see. But what I'm sure of is that the people do disappear at checkpoints, and then their relatives have to try their best and basically to give money to the Russians in order to know a little bit more about the whereabouts of their loved ones.
Are most people searching for somebody who they know who has disappeared?
I don't know a single person in Chechnya who is not looking for someone else, for someone. And not a single one.
And most of them have to try to bribe Russians in order to get some information?
Most of them are bribing the Russian officials. What's happening now in Chechnya is only about money, human trafficking. So people disappearing and the family having to pay them back, buy them back. I don't know how to say that. But also, dead bodies are also for sale. 3 weeks ago, I saw in the middle of Grozny, I saw 47 dead bodies just lying on the ground. Those were the bodies that had been found not far from the Russian military base, Khankala. And of course, immediately the Russian propaganda said, "Well, those are rebels. Look at them; they wear military forms." Untrue. I saw them. None of them was wearing military forms, and there were at least three women among them, and not a single one had not been tortured. I mean, everybody I saw bore signs of torturing.
So if the Russians have tortured and killed a Chechen, and you want to find out what happened to that person, you could buy back their corpse from the Russians?
That's exactly right. That's exactly what you do. Basically, there is nothing else to do. There is no justice system at all. when the Russians pretend that there are some legal ways of finding out about, you know, official inquiries, that's not true, absolutely untrue. Chechnya is a place where everything is possible. It's complete lawlessness. There is nothing functioning in this tiny territory south of Russia. Absolutely nothing, including the Russian army.
You've interviewed Russian military men?
Yes, yes, I did, because sometimes I would meet with, my way would just cross their way, and if I would be sure that they would not, like, denounce me, and I would talk to them, and mainly, I didn't meet with a Russian soldier who would have told me, well, I'm happy to be here and to fight against those rebels, and here I am. Basically, what they say is, we don't understand this war. We're going to lose it the way we lost it in 96, and nothing is going to change.
Since it's so difficult for men to walk the streets because they could be picked up by Russian soldiers at any point and interrogated or tortured or killed, are women becoming more assertive, having to do some of the activities that men can't do because they have to stay more hidden?
Oh, yes, you're right. Yes, that's one of the primary consequences of this war. Yes, women are in charge. Women are really in charge. Women, of course, women do educate the children, and there are still a lot of children down there. How many? I never saw so many pregnant women during my numerous stays in Chechnya. Almost every woman is pregnant. I remember during the heavy shelling, I was always shocked by that, and I would ask them why they would still have babies. Basically, first of all, of course, they don't have any sort of ideas of what is contraception about. And secondly, they would always answer me that each time their population is gaining a million, the Russians attack them for them not to be 1 million. So they are making babies because their feeling is that they are being exterminated.
If you're just joining us, my guest is French journalist Anne Neva. She's based in Moscow, but she's covered the Chechen War off and on for several years now, and she has a new book called Chienne de Guerre. It's a memoir about being a woman reporter behind the lines of the war in Chechnya. You've interviewed doctors and psychiatrists about their work in Chechnya during this war. One of the doctors you spoke to performed 60 amputations on soldiers and civilians in one day with an electric saw. Were you there for that?
Yes, unfortunately I was. I would have preferred not to have seen that. And by the way, this doctor is now in the U.S. because he was it was dangerous for him to stay there. But
is he a Russian doctor, a Chechen doctor?
A Chechen doctor, a Chechen doctor. And he would be hated by the Russians because he had amputated and sort of helped the rebels, but also hated by the rebels because he also had helped some Russians. A doctor is a doctor. A doctor doesn't make differences between people. The medical situation in Chechnya is also beyond comprehension. It's awful. There is absolutely nothing. That's why the only thing to do was to amputate. And you know, how do you amputate someone? You just, when you have no modern clinic or whatever, you just do with whatever you have handy.
Do they have anesthetics?
No, everything without anesthetics. No one knows what is anesthetics about in Chechnya. People suffer. Without even saying a word. That's what is life in Chechnya today.
So these 60 amputations were performed without anesthesia.
Absolutely right.
And without antibiotics also.
Absolutely. And the top rebel, his name is Shamil Basayev, was amputated this very day you are referring to. And I remember I saw him when the doctor was performing the amputation. This rebel is still in, this top rebel, terrorist number one, is still in Chechnya today and free of his movements.
Why were 60 amputations even necessary? What were the injuries caused by?
The injuries were caused by a group of people having crossed a minefield, leaving the capital, leaving Grozny. And that happened at the very last day of January 2000 and the first 2 days of February. A group of 1,200 rebels with civilians left the capital and they just walked through a minefield. And basically, the other kind of problem is heavy shelling.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also talked to psychiatrists about the psychological impact of the war.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that you were told?
Yeah, I remember this woman who is a Chechen woman, but I didn't talk to her in Chechnya. I talked to her in the neighboring republic of Ingushetia, which is basically where most of the Chechens took refuge, trying to escape the shelling. Basically, what she said is that this war is devastating for people's mind and that they're... Everyone is depressed, so it made me sort of minimize all kind of, people. Of course, people have different reasons to be depressed here in the West. But in comparison to what's happening in Chechnya, I understand that's very easy to be depressed. If you live in Chechnya, you have no future. There is no work, no jobs, no comfort at all, and a permanent danger of being killed.
And Neva has written a memoir about covering the war in Chechnya. It's called Chien de Guerre. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at SaabUSA.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we begin a six-part series on modern jazz mavericks, beginning with pianist and bandleader Sun Ra. Also, French journalist Anne Neva tells us what happened when the Russians discovered that she was a journalist. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with French journalist Anne Neva. She's written a memoir called Chien de Guerre about covering the war in Chechnya. The Russians had denied her application for press credentials to cover the war. They don't want journalists to cover the war on their own. So she disguised herself as a Chechen woman. For 6 months, she traveled through Chechnya, staying mostly with Chechen families. You were deported in February of 2000. Russian soldiers came to the house that you were staying in. They searched everyone's belongings, including yours. They found your satellite phone. I guess they found other things that made it clear that you were a journalist and one,
yes,
one who didn't have their proper, you know, Russian press credentials to be in Chechnya. How did they tell you that you were going to be deported?
Basically, you know, that's a pathetic story, I would say, because when they found me, this very day, when they searched this house and took my satellite phone and my notebooks and etc., they were not really looking for me, not at all, I must say. So I can't say that they were looking for me and they found me. They were not. They were, you know, Russian. Those were Russian secret service officers, and they were just executing orders. They probably had received the order to search this house. And that was just by complete chance. That was the house I was staying in, south of Grozny. So when they took my satellite phone and I introduced myself to them, because again, none of them would ask me for my ID, which made me actually understand that they were not coming for me, because I would have expected one of them to ask me for my ID, and I would have provided him with my French passport, but none of them asked. But because they took away my satellite phone, and I didn't want them to believe that this satellite phone was the head of the house one, this Chechen guy by whom I was saying. I was ashamed. I didn't want to
endanger him.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I introduced myself to the FSB officer. I remember me saying to him in Russian, "Well, my name is Anne Neva, I'm a journalist. This is my satellite phone." And believe what? He did not pay attention to me. That's something amazing. But basically, that shows a lot about the way they function down there. He did not pay attention to what I told him because he was busy filling out some papers regarding the search, and because he had no orders to listen to a strange young woman telling him that she was a journalist. But the thing is that they took my stuff away, and then I could not work anymore. Who I am if I don't have my satellite phone? You know, you can be the best journalist on earth. If you don't have technically the possibility of filing your story, you don't exist. So I decided to wait for them to come back, because I understood that they, after having understood that they had made a mistake in not paying attention to me, they would come back and ask me questions, which is exactly what happened. But it took them time. They came back after 5 days, I think. So during 5 days, I was missing for the outside world, and my editors became scared, of course, in France. But I could have escaped. I could have left the place when they left after having not taken me away with them. I could have left. When they would have come back, they would have not found me. But I stayed. I stayed because I decided that this encounter with them would be unavoidable, and I wanted my sat phone back. I really wanted my sat phone back. So when they came back with the owner of the house, after having questioned him in the military headquarters, and probably he repeated to them that this sat phone was mine, they came back, the same FSB officer, quite a young guy, my age. He came back, I remember, smiling, and he asked me, "Well, are you Anne Neva?" I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Well, I would like to, would you mind if we would talk?" And I said, "Of course I wouldn't mind, and may I recall you that I introduced myself to you 5 days ago and you didn't pay attention?" He stayed silent. And then I said, "Well," I was furious, because I told him, "Well, you made me wait 5 days. I was basically waiting for you." Then they questioned me for an entire day, which was not really pleasant. But I must say, they really behaved. They did not. They were not aggressive with me. They were more perplexed.
So the Secret Service, the former KGB, came back for you in 5 days. They interrogated you for a day. After the Secret Service came back for you, they decided to deport you. They took you to Muzdok,
right,
which is where the military headquarters are.
Yes.
Were you relieved in a way that you were going to actually get this, like, Russian Secret Service escort out of Chechnya into Muzdok, and then they were going to fly you back to Moscow? So, I mean, you were going to at least be pretty sure you were going to be safe.
In a way, you're absolutely right. I was so relieved that it was so fascinating for me, I must say, to cross the checkpoints with them in army jeep so easily. Because, of course, those are their checkpoints. And when during, you know, 6 months, each time I was crossing a checkpoint, it was high risk and I was not feeling very well. Well, this very day, I was just with them and we were flying through Chechnya to go to Muzdok. But at the same time, I was also disappointed. I was furious against myself because that was the end of my trip. And I didn't want to talk to them. I didn't want to have to explain to them everything. But, well, of course, I was forced to. What can you do when you are questioned by an FSB officer and they ask you? Basically, I remember I was the most difficult for me was to try to remember what was already published about what I had already published in my newspaper about the whereabouts of the rebels' whereabouts, because I didn't want to provide them with any further information. So that was a constant effort for me to remember what I had already written about. And I also remember that they were so surprised to find me and to understand that I had been filing so many articles without really them knowing about, at least those to whom I was talking to. And I told them, well, because they wanted to know what I had been writing about. I said, well, you know, have a look, go to the internet.
Exactly, right.
And have a look at my articles.
Yeah.
And you know what? They answered they had no internet access. It was so funny. Well, and then they wanted me to translate to them my notes. So, because basically I wrote notes in French. They wanted me to translate everything in Russian. How absurd. Of course I would never do them this favor. I think they have enough translators.
Did you pretend to?
You're right, yes. I did pretend to. I remember when this young officer sat down in front of me and said, well, Anne, let's have a look at your notes. So what did you write in this page? What is it all about? And I pretended that I was like describing a scene in a village, which was absolutely untrue. But I thought he would not understand French. But after that, I remember he stood up and instead of giving me my notes back, he went to the copy machine and he photocopied every single page of my book note. So then I realized that he would probably give that to someone else and that they would understand that I was lying to them.
My guest is French journalist Anne Neva. She's written a memoir about covering the war in Chechnya called Chien de Guerre. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Anne Neva is my guest. She's a French journalist who's usually based in Moscow. She's been covering the war in Chechnya, but she's usually not accredited when she goes in, so she usually has to kind of sneak in. She has a new memoir about covering the war called Chien de Guerre. So you were deported by the Russian Secret Service. You were deported from Chechnya to Moscow, but you weren't deported out of Russia.
You are right, and I'm very thankful to them that they didn't deport me out of Russia, because I love Russia and I want to stay in Russia and I want to continue my job there.
Well, in fact, you were able to actually go back to Chechnya once with official press credentials, which meant that you traveled with the Russian military and they kind of selectively show you what they want you to see.
Absolutely right. I did them this favor because when I came back, when I was deported to Moscow, and there was such a fuss around me, and everyone, so of course the commission in charge of providing the journalists with this ad hoc accreditation would immediately give it to me. As if, you know, it was like a great honor now to give this accreditation to Anne Niva. But basically, I didn't need it. I didn't want it. I had always said I would never travel with those interest-like groups of journalists, which means basically the Russian authorities would just organize Moscow accredited foreign journalists to travel with them under their control to Chechnya in order to cover the war, which is basically what most of the journalists did. I didn't until the 3 days in August, when I did it just to please them and just to prove them that it was not interesting to travel this way.
What did the Russians show you when you went with your press credentials on the little Russian press tour?
They just show you that they are running an anti-terrorist operation, that everything is under control, and that that's fine. There is nothing special going on in Chechnya. That's what they wanted me to write about.
And did you write that?
No, of course not, because that would have contradicted all my other stories. No, what I wrote is, you know, I described the way they showed journalists around.
Right. You were writing for a French audience. You were mm-hmm. filing for French newspapers. What stories had the most impact, and what was the impact?
I think the impact, which actually I did not realize being there, because I was a freelancer when I was filing those stories. I was not writing only for this French Daily Libération. I was really a freelancer. I was by myself, completely by myself. I had not been sent by any redaction. And I must say, I think if I would have been sent by my editors to Chechnya, I would have never been able to do what I did, because I took too many risks. But I'm glad I took them, because the result is some sort of a feuilleton in this coverage of the war. And I think that was the impact. The impact in France, which I've been told about afterwards, was that people would wait for my articles to come out every day. They would like talk about them between themselves, and they would expect a new article about this war. That was during the peak of the war, which is the winter 99-2000. The peak being the turning point of the war, this very day when the rebels left Grozny, the capital, by walking through this minefield, and I witnessed it.
Now, I've read that your stories in French newspapers led to French demonstrations at the Russian embassy, demonstrations against the war. Is that right? And did you know about it while you were in Chechnya?
No, of course I didn't know. While in Chechnya, I knew absolutely nothing, absolutely nothing. When I was dictating my article written by hand on the satellite phone, I would not, you know, waste some time in asking, you know, Paris what was going on in Paris, because I was so anxious about the battery of my satellite phone.
Right.
So I was obsessed by that. So I didn't know about that, and I was functioning like a camera. You know, there was no camera TV crew covering this war, unfortunately, except Russian crews, but they were siding with the Russian army. So I was functioning like a camera myself, just describing with words what I was seeing. And that was, I think, very powerful for the readers. And that's why they would demonstrate one or two times in Paris. And also that's why Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, did not come to France during this time. He refused an invitation from Paris.
I have one last question for you. How have you dealt with the stress of being in Chechnya, where there's very little food, where there's constant risk?
Difficult, yes. But there is little food, but what I was eating was basically Snickers, chocolate bars, that I could find anywhere in Chechnya. Don't ask me why, but I would like eat 8 or 9 of them during a day and drink a lot of tea, hot tea. Of course, I was scared. I was scared the way I had never been scared in my life. And but it was too late, you know. Once you are there, that's too late to go back. So I was there under the shelling, and I was thinking about death, of course, but at the same time I was hoping to survive, and I did. But unfortunately, I saw many people around me dying civilians. And that was very difficult to witness.
And Eva, thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you the best of luck in your continued coverage.
Thank you.
And Neva has written a new memoir about covering the war in Chechnya. It's called Chien de Guerre. Coming up, Avant-Garde Made Easy, a new series that we begin with the music of Sun Ra. This is Fresh Air. So-called avant-garde jazz is often regarded as difficult to understand and a rejection of the jazz tradition. Our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, says it's usually deeply rooted in established practices and not so hard to appreciate once you know where it's coming from. We invited Kevin to tell us about half a dozen modern jazz mavericks he thinks are important and to point out things to listen for. We begin our series with pianist, composer, and bandleader Sun Ra. He was born Herman Blunt in Birmingham, Alabama, in 1914, although later in life he claimed to have come here via the planet Saturn. In the 1950s, he put together his orchestra, which later became famous for its carnival-like stage shows, with musicians in colorful costumes, playing quasi-African percussion, dancing in a conga line, chanting pro-space, anti-Earth slogans. Sun Ra recorded well over 100 albums in a bewildering array of styles.
Because the guy's name was Sun Ra, and his orchestra wore tinfoil hats and chanted about space travel, and almost every sentence he uttered was an enigma wrapped in a pun, it was hard for some folks to really listen to his music, including some who went to his gigs because of the wacky stuff. But there was always a keen musical intelligence behind it. Sometimes, trying to make sense of a puzzling artist's work, it helps to go back to their sources. Listen to the intro to a 1949 tune by the great bebop composer Tad Dameron. Like Tad Dameron, Sun Ra had a weakness for almost disembodied horn chords made up of oddly spaced notes with a heavy bottom end. Such writing made medium-sized groups like theirs sound bigger. You can really hear the Dameron connection in my favorite Sun Ra period, the mid-50s to early 60s. This is from his version of David Raxon's The Bad and the Beautiful. New England Conservatory's Alan Chase has documented how Sun Ra wrote melodies and chord voicings to exploit the resonant overtones of various size saxophones. He could get a sound like nobody else, as on L is the Sound of Joy from 1956, using a saxophone trio. Really separate Sun Ra's music from his cosmic mythosophy. Those eerily disembodied voicings reflect his desire to be on some better planet than this one. He wrote or covered a number of tunes about dreaming. I dream too much, daydream, dreams come true, as if he sought to escape life on Earth or dismissed it as an illusion. Sun Ra's music acquired a greater urgency in the mid-1960s. Free jazz was in the air, but the prospect of humans visiting other celestial bodies may have quickened his blood, too. He used to warn Earthlings to stay off his moon. Ra also got into the futuristic qualities of electronic keyboards, often placing them in an otherworldly context. The music had changed, but he still had a great sense of atmosphere. Despite the echoes of free jazz, Sun Ra was a strict disciplinarian who believed in rehearsing a lot, sweating out the details of his sometimes intricate rhythms. Even so, as his reputation grew, more musicians gravitated to him, and his group eventually swelled to big band size. None of his disciples was more widely respected or stayed longer than tenor saxophonist John Gilmore. His fans included John Coltrane. Gilmore stuck around for four decades, with timeouts to play with Miles Davis, Freddie Hubbard, Art Blakey, or Paul Bley. But for Gilmore, Sun Ra had more on the ball than any of them. From the mid-1970s till Sun Ra died in 93, his big band would offset the hardcore space numbers and conducted improvisations with revivals of charts by swing band leaders like his early idol Fletcher Henderson. It's hard to imagine any modern jazz fan who can't find something to like in Sun Ra's music. Few jazz composers had a greater scope, and no quick survey can touch on all of it. It was as if one planet couldn't contain everything he could dream up.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic based in Chicago. His series Avant-Garde Made Easy continues next week with the music of Lester Bowie. The series is produced by Roberta Sharrock. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The True Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet journalists Lou Michel and Dan Herbeck, authors of the new book on Timothy McVeigh, which is based on 80 hours of interviews with him. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.